story does not end. Because, if it were so, humanity would cease to exist. Therefore, in the absence of an ending, a story evolves and even merges with other stories, thus breathing life into a new chapter.
Bakhona abantu abanama-disability lapho manikhulu emapulazini.
Hey, abaningi.
Ama-disability anjani?
Abanye abakwazi ukuhamba. Abanye izandla azikwazi ukusebenza. Abanye ingqondo nyana zawo azisebenzi kahle. Abanye bayidala zomzalwa nje. Abakwazi ukukhuluma.
So bona baphathwa kanjani emapulazini?
Hawu, kunendaba naye lo muntu. Akabalwa nasesibaleni sabantu. Nokuthi mhlawumbe kungathiwa akakatholi noma i-2 cent nyana naye-ke. Ngoba naye nakakwazi ukuzenzela ba abazali bakhe, ifamily yakhe yiyo zabona ukuthi yenza njani. Hayi.
You are hearing a conversation that my grandmother and I had while we were on a road trip. Because you might be wondering what is being talked about, I will sum it up in one sentence. My gran is recounting her years as a farm dweller and worker in 1940s and 1950s South Africa. As I switch gears to ponder on the advocacy space I work in, I think about the accounts of many other ordinary people whose stories are eerily similar to that of Mamangalas in present-day South Africa.
Going up.
You and I will be exploring these narratives through the knowledge and experiences of experts, activists, and people who live in farming communities.
Level 8.
I am Melusi Ngala, Senior Researcher at Corruption Watch and your host for this Land and Corruption podcast series. I wish to encourage you to listen to the previous episodes of the series. These contain details that will inform you of what's to come in this edition. If you have already listened to prior episodes, thank you for joining me again. Just to make sure that we are on the same page, let us recap what happened previously.
I was part of a trust, or I still am part of a trust, and then we bought the farm, and my workers was part of a trust by themselves.
They have everything easy. They will come from Optiberg just to come and play tennis.
For less time than what you actually work.
That's good.
And then they would pay you less money.
That's good.
To think so is tantamount to normalizing poverty and violence in one of the most unequal societies in the world.
My excitement is, ek meen dan die eerste plek het hulle vir ons gesê, okay, na 5 jaar gaan julle julle eerste betaling kry.
The voorstands at that time were not really economically viable. At the moment they did equity schemes, they had huge sums of money coming in from government.
The story of the marginalized who work and live on farms in South Africa is one of despair and inhumaneness. Those responsible for the state of depravity certainly have a lot to answer to in this regard. In relation to equity schemes, one of the stakeholders that we should pose questions to is the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. The department paid approximately 30 million rand in fees to consultants, some who were their own former employees, to design these equity schemes. Yet, based on the account heard throughout this podcast series, we know of acts of financial mismanagement, including possible corruption, as well as human rights violations that occurred on farms. But also, the department's Zalo Capital report on equity schemes highlights that officials may have flouted processes relating to the evaluation of farm businesses and the subsequent disbursement of funds. That aside, on a high level, the failures of the equity schemes program is arguably linked to the shortfalls of the land reform laws in South Africa.
During that period, after the unbanning of the ANC, I was doing policy work in the headquarters of the African National Congress. And because I knew something about it, I'd not only continued my reading on agriculture, etc., but I'd also developed an interest in land reform. So I was responsible for land and agricultural policies.
That is Derek Hanekom. He is a South African politician and former Minister of Agriculture and Land Affairs. This is a video by Hort Grow titled 20 Years of Fruit Freedom, found on YouTube. The event was a summit meeting held by Hort Grow celebrating 20 years of deregulation in South Africa's agriculture industry.
My earlier background was developing a love for agriculture and then becoming really fascinated in some of the agricultural policy issues. That critical period before 1994, before the first elections, was a very important policy-making period. And that is when I, in that capacity as coordinator of policies, made contact with people like Johan van Sail, Nick Funk, Eckhart Kassir, and they were all part of they all contributed towards the ANC policy-making process. Because in effect, it was seen as the ANC preparing itself to govern. The World Bank assisted us a great deal then as well.
In the video, Hanekom goes on to outline facets of agriculture that had to be considered in policy formation. After his deregulation plans hit a snag with the Marketing of Agricultural Products Act of 1993, assured that the African National Congress would govern after South Africa's 1994 elections, Hanekom and others allowed for the law to be passed unchallenged.
Janet Love was then the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, and she went through a very intense period of consultation, worked actually quite closely with the South African Agricultural Union then, that became AgriSA later, and worked with the industry, and of course individuals assisted her, and they basically recrafted that act. And that act gave expression to some of our policies. And that act was very, very specific on the deregulation of the agricultural market or reform of the agricultural marketing system. And it gave us in the executive 1 year effectively to demolish all of the marketing boards or control boards as they are called in Afrikaans, beheer rade, to close them down and to put alternative systems in place to take the funds that they may have accumulated, put them into trust funds. And so in that very rapid period, I suppose, after the passing of that act, very dramatic changes happened in agriculture. So all of the marketing boards did close down. And those that did have money in their accounts, those monies were transferred into trusts.
One of those boards that became a trust is Hort Grow. But the entity's history goes farther back than 1980s and 1990s South Africa. As stated on its website, and I quote, Our roots date back to the spring of 1652, when the Dutch East India Company founded the Cape of Good Hope as a refreshment outpost for its passing ships.
What Derek did was that he went to his friends at the old Agri South Africa, and he asked them, help me to design the policies. So he went to the devil to say, help me read the butt. And then he went to certain academics at Stellenbosch. You know, Kassir and Kirsten and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and said, listen, guys, help me design this stuff. So one of those in that design package was deregulate the agricultural boards.
Uncle Ismail, the independent farmer whom we heard in the previous episodes, attended the Hort Grow event. Based on his decades of experience in the agriculture industry, he states that the ruling ANC made a mistake.
Now, in the naivety of our politicians and the ANC leadership at that time, who had, in retrospect, were absolutely clueless about the agricultural sector and the value of the agricultural economy, that they fell for all of this hook, line, and sinker. And what had happened was deregulation sounds nice, but deregulation meant that these boards became privatized.
Could it be that the effects of those policies have resulted in the continuous suffering of farm workers and tenants? Or maybe the hardships experienced by the rural poor are mitigated by the country's constitutional safeguards and commercial farmers' goodwill? With this in mind, we discussed two matters with the experts you heard from in previous episodes. The first pertained to the protection of poor persons in farming communities, and the second relates to positive initiatives that are aimed at social upliftment or improving human rights conditions. Terence Corrigan from the Institute of Race Relations views the question on the protection of human rights of farm workers and tenants broadly. This is because he believes that commercial farmers are victims too.
We hear a great deal about farm attacks and farm killings. Now, I prefer to use the term rural crime because I think it's a much more expansive concept. A vulnerable farmer being attacked in his farmhouse or a farm worker being assaulted by the farm manager, that's all really part of the same system. In a properly functioning society, you would go to the authorities, the police or prosecution service or whatever, report it and have that properly investigated and prosecuted. And if there was merit in the claim, that could come out in court and there'd be an appropriate sentence. The problem, I think, is simply that those systems are either so incapacitated that you often just don't get that. I've heard dozens of stories, not necessarily about the abuse of farm workers, but I'm sure it's applicable. In one case, a police officer refused to serve a court order because he said that they don't have petrol. If your resources have been run down to that degree where you don't have the professional interest, abuse is going to take place without much sanction.
Where Terence's focus is on the professional conduct and resources, Mashulu Masuta, the parliamentarian researcher who is speaking in her personal capacity, looks at this question holistically, taking into account the country's legal structures and the social factors of poor people in rural communities.
At the core of it, any kind of redress that comes as a result of a human rights violation needs to go through your usual legal process. In the sense that you're either going to get some kind of compensation as a result of the harm that has been caused, or the person who's going to cause harm is going to be liable for it in the form of fine to the state or imprisonment, depending on the extent at which the harm was caused. So at the core, you are relying on a legal system that is supposed to provide you with that redress. The legal system in South Africa is not designed for your marginalized groups. It is very difficult for people who cannot afford legal representation. The justice system, it's not accessible for your marginalized groups.
Those socioeconomic factors play a role in whether poor people receive justice in respect to land matters. Mashudu does say that the state-funded legal entity recently started accepting land cases. That said, this is not a well-known fact. And at present, logistically, these offices are far from impacted communities. The other avenue is the land court. It allows for people to represent themselves without legal counsel. Be that as it may, Mashudu's concern with this setup is that in instances where tribal authority members are presiding officers, women and young people may be disadvantaged. The president of Black First Land First, Andile Mngitama, agrees with Mashudu's point on the existence of avenues and the shortfalls of the country's legal frameworks. He, however, suggests that the problem is in the poor conception of the laws.
There's multiple institutions that have been established. If, for instance, you suffer administrative injustice, you can go to the public protector. Or if you suffer discrimination, you go to the Human Rights Commission. However, there are no sufficient laws grounded in the historical exclusion of Black people to assist us when we face racism, for instance, to be able to get redress. Up to today, racism is not outlawed. So you can't go to a police station and open a case of racism. It is called crimina injuria. And as we've seen in some of these recent cases, Penny Sparrow and so on, people get about 3 years suspended sentences, some kind of a fine. There is no clear, systematic, resolute process to address racism. And that is part of the compromises which were made in 1994. We have not established a legal infrastructure to address the historical questions of exclusion and justice.
Mashudu and Andile's point about vulnerable people finding it difficult to access institutional assistance is illustrated by Anushka Williams and Naomi Batana's experiences. Speaking on behalf of the Surplus People's Project and the Wittenberg Justice Coalition, the two activists highlight incidents relating to law enforcement officials.
A lot of our experiences here has been that the police are very reluctant to take on farm worker cases. They often get dismissed, and I don't mean dismissed as in the case is dismissed. They are dismissed by even having the ability to make a case. So police officers would say, oh, you are drunk, just leave, or why are you making an issue about this? Police don't take seriously the issues and the abuses against farm workers.
I was in the police station assisting one of the grannies from the township with her sasa peyoto. She had to make an affidavit. And I could see the lady standing in front of me, the queue, is a farm worker. I could just see the way that she's dressed. And the police official was so rude with her. I had to say, but sorry, what's happening here now? Can you not speak properly? And it was an assault case. She was physically assaulted by her partner. And she tried to explain to him that she came from Optiber and Optiber must go to PA Hamlet. She went to PA Hamlet police station. PA Hamlet told her it's not their work, she must come to Sierras. So she came to, and she tried to explain that to him in a very sensitive, afraid voice. So I said, oh, you're not afraid.
Meanwhile, Mam Tepra Mutuku's experiences as the co-founder of the South African Women in Farming Organization shows that even administrators at the Limpopo provincial government offices are apathetic to the plight of women.
What made us to give up or to lose hope in such avenues is because I can tell you, Melus, we've been marching with memoranda going from this office to that office. The memoranda was taken to the premier. He never acknowledged receipt of that memoranda. We were complaining about an abattoir in our area because we have these chicken houses where we need to go and slaughter our chickens and get into the formal market. The abattoir has been standing there for more than 12 years. It's unused. We don't know who is going to open it for people to make use of it.
The consequence of having an institutional framework that fails to meet the needs of ordinary people is that it leads to distrust. Thapelo Mohapi from Abahlali baseMjondolo says that the members of his organization have little trust in the institutions that are meant to protect the vulnerable.
Some of the Chapter 9 institutions have failed us in a very big way that we no longer even want to approach those institutions. One of them was the South African Human Rights Committee, where we reported many of the attacks and repression that we are facing, and nothing has been done to actually deal with that. We had to march to their offices. And so people have lost hope because the so-called Chapter 9 institutions that are supposed to actually deal with these issues are not dealing with them.
In terms of the question on whether there are positive initiatives aimed at improving human rights conditions or social upliftment for the marginalized in farming communities, the responses touched upon who was driving these initiatives and whether these initiatives were helpful. Terence says that vetting accreditation associations are an example of mechanisms that protect workers' and dwellers' rights.
There are a number of NGOs, I think, particularly in places like the Western Cape and the wine farms. The ones that I think actually have the greatest effect in terms of commercial farming would probably be those ethical farming trade agreements. Essentially, what happens is that in order to sell in the particular market, you have to be certified as complying with a basket of labor human rights standards. So like no child labor, that sort of thing. They're often quite rigorous. I'm sure that there are some mistakes made.
He also stated that there are farms that provide social services like medical care. Andile says that he has heard of such a farm, but he has some reservations.
I think in the Western Cape, there's one farmer there in the Cape Winelands who has given equity to his farm workers and build a school. He's also apparently taking care of the health needs of the people. It is a charity-based model. Which does not change the power dynamics between the farm worker and the farm owner. So I'm not in favor of that. Because to end the exclusion of black people from land, we have to change the power dynamics between the white farmers and their workers. Until they operate on the basis of equitable power dynamics, it's going to be a situation of yab me bus all the time. So I don't think that charity-driven kind of interventions will address the land question.
Naomi holds the same view and goes on to say that such farming businesses have these initiatives because they receive a stamp of approval from the international agriculture market.
Oh, they have a school on their farm. Ask them out of that school. Why don't they take them to Charlie? How many children do they take to the private school? Ask them how many children who are doing good in sports are they assisting at higher academies. They're doing it for charity.
What makes her say this is not only the quality of the education that the children receive, but the quality of the infrastructure too.
They have a school at Resource Leal. The social year has taken a storeroom, and then the private initiative like Windplus, you see the people that comes with this renewable energy. They have assisted one of the biggest monopoly and they have revamped it into a school. And then we ask, but what bullshit is this? First of all, are you using a storeroom for a school? Why you can build a school on your farm? Second to that, Windplus, why are you helping a billionaire while there's schools needed in Prince Alfred and it?
Worryingly, Aside from these initiatives, there were no other private sector-led programs that were thought of as empowering for the marginalized in rural communities. In general, all the people who we talked with considered civil society organizations as the most progressive contributors in the space. In fact, evidence of the significance of NGOs can be seen in the work done by the sector in a community in Limpopo. Mashuru says that the sector created a platform where a private entity and community members interact.
Kukune is an area where Anglo-American has been operating for a very long time. The community has been talking about most of the human rights violations that we've talked about during this interview and how the best way to mitigate the violations is to have a level of engagement, communication, open cause, transparency. So what are the plans that the mining company has? What are the plans that the community has? Can there be some kind of synergy that happens? So what has happened in this area is that they have created a communication protocol about how the engagement processes are going to take place and what do they do about the complaints that the community has about the mine and what they are doing in the community that is causing some of these human rights violations. The interesting part about this is that you have the community and you have the mining company that's there, but then you also have civil society that plays almost an observer role. So they were pivotal in facilitating the relationship. Once the relationship was set, then terms were agreed upon. Civil society then took a step back and they just purely observed how the relationship has progressed. So you have a relationship between the mining right holder and the land right holder. And it's specific to deal with impact and how the mining company can ensure that what they're doing does not also affect their operations, because at the end of the day, communities are very powerful. They can affect your revenue lines and also their social license to operate as well. So it's a mutually beneficial agreement and protocol that they have.
But given the legislative challenges, human rights abuses, as well as the acts of criminality and corruption prevalent in the land sector, what else can be done to bring about change?
I think political was the most important. I think you have a situation where the ruling government, it does not have a clear pathway to land reform. The conversations of land restitution have been there. There has been marginal wins in that space. But what exactly is the ruling government's position when it comes to it? And I think that is the problem. And this is not a slight on the ANC necessarily. It's a slight on the fact that it just happens to be that the ANC is the ruling party. But now you have a situation where the government of the day doesn't have a position on what is now becoming a very important aspect of South African lives. The process to which the expropriation bill took within parliament was a circus. It had a life of its own. Okay, it was unique in the sense that you're trying to amend the constitution. But if there was a direction as to what it is that the position of land is, even for the ruling party, we would not be in the situation that we are in right now, where this is a bill that's hanging. That's the one issue. The other is the issue of corruption. The level of corruption that takes place for land right holders that are housing minerals or commodities is absolutely incredible. And the fact that there has been no accountability in that space explains why we are where we are insofar as the land reform question.
With regard to the graft problem that Mashuru speaks of, Terence says that the corruption and the criminal activity can be mitigated by a functional state.
You need a state that does its job. So, you know, when you have those egregious violations where someone is assaulted or murdered, there are systems that will step in, punish the offender. But more than that, actually a sense that wrongdoing is not consequence-free.
While, in relation to land policies, he proposes support for business and property rights.
I believe that we need to rethink the way that land reform is being done. And what I mean by that is not everyone wants land for the same purposes. And we have to acknowledge that there are limits to what you are going to get out of land reform. The idea that land reform or peasant agriculture is going to provide a solution to South Africa's socioeconomic problems, it's not true. Certainly not the agrarian side. South Africa is now two-thirds urbanized. There's no going back. And it's interesting how many areas that 20 years ago were being farmed by sort of peasant smallholders have now been abandoned. But there are some opportunities. So what I would like to see being done with land reform is accept that your existing commercial farmers are an asset, you want to keep them. You want to bring more commercial farmers in. So we need to identify those people who are serious about farming. Obtaining land is actually not the key problem, and certainly the protection of property rights. You know, you need to get agricultural unions and particularly local farmers' bodies involved. And you need processes of mentoring, but here's the thing that we are not doing, which I think we need to. You need to actually give those new entrants ownership or at least a path to ownership.
In contrast, Andile holds a different perspective to that of Terence's in respect to land ownership.
And of course, there are two big arguments. The first argument for land redress is a historical one, and the most important one. To say land must be returned to black people. Then there's a second one, which is economic. The South African agricultural sector is highly, highly unproductive. It is environmentally harmful, and it's socially oppressive, and it's economically unproductive. We don't employ in the agricultural sector even 3 million people. It's way less than that. If you were to bring in new farmers, you will push up productivity very high, but also address the economic exclusion of the black majority. But that will require a massive redistribution of land and massive support of new farmers, which the South African government is unable to do.
As much as all of these responses may give us a great deal to think about, it was sobering to hear Uncle Ismail's answer to this question.
Sometimes I look back and say, I spent 20 years in all of this. 20 years giving my time, my energy. I've gained a lot of knowledge. I say this, I can make more money writing a book than farming, which is great. But I sit back and I think, what have I actually achieved? I have not achieved this goal of saying black people must own the economy of agriculture. I have not achieved that. And I have not achieved the fact by saying that this land belongs to the indigenous peoples of this country. And I'm very clear, I am not indigenous. I have no rights or ownership of this land. And I'm clear, I've said this in many podiums. I've not achieved that in 20 years.
Apart from the innumerable challenges that he has overcome and still is facing as a black farmer, some of his dejection is also born out of the thought that the marginalized people of South Africa were party to a bad political deal at the Congress of Democratic South Africa meetings.
We had CODESA. We didn't understand everything, and up to today, we still don't have all the information, especially the sunset clauses and so on that happened at CODESA. And unfortunately, that two things at CODESA were not very clear. One I know is that there was a 20-year moratorium on the Water Act, which meant that in the first 20 years, all available water was taken up and licensed by white landowners. 5 or 6 years ago, there was a VNV verification process that Department of Water Affairs did here in the Western Cape, a very expensive exercise. In fact, using some of the former employees as consultants. And that exercise shows that there is no excess water available in this province, which doesn't make sense to me. Meaning that everything is already licensed.
Yes.
There's no free water. And that is what this moratorium has done. The other part of what was not discussed at CODESA is ownership of land and ownership of the economy.
Nevertheless, he still believes that there is a practical solution to some of the problems.
There are huge, huge amounts of opportunity in this country if we have the ability to actually use this land to its fullest capabilities and capacity. And I don't believe for once that our people, and especially black people, and especially indigenous people in our country, are incapable of managing this land. We have so much of wealth in the soil. We have so much, it's so huge, that I don't believe that our political fathers have actually understand this. The wealth is there. We just need to unlock things like ownership, financing, unlock the control of the economy, unlock who markets what where, unlock the ownership of genetic material, unlock all of that. That's all locked. It's closed. Once we open all of that, it's unbelievable. And it's not an issue of each one has owned thousands of hectares. It is an issue of, even in villages, how do I capacitate people to own? I mean, one of the paper that I'm doing now within the deciduous is to say, what do we do to capacitate people in the villages? We have thousands of people in our villages who have socioeconomic problems. But if I can plant 10 peach trees in each household in a village, and if I have 1,000, I got 10,000 trees, I can then capacitate 3 or 4 people to become entrepreneurs, to dry, to jam, to can, to juice, and sell it in a neighboring village.
Back on the road trip with my grandmother, as she quizzes me on the research that the team and I conducted, I think about how the greed of a few individuals has led to the distress, trauma, and misery of many families and communities. In my mind, I replay the beneficiaries' stories. I hear the pain in their voices as they wish for the most basic.
Dit is my geld wat ek verdien vir die aantal jare wat ek gewerk het. Wil ek hier? En ek voel, ek het hier inkomste gehad. As ek nou tot sterwe kom, wie gaan vir my begrawe? Wie gaan vir my begrawe? Gee my geld wat ek uitgegee het vir my begrawe, sodat ek vir my verdere polis gaan uitneem. Gee dit wat ek wil hê. Regverdigheid moet reg geskied.
I recall the proud and loving manner in which they spoke about the farms that they believe belong to them too.
Want ek het hierdie plek, ons het hierdie plek opgebouw. Mm-hmm. Tot waar hy vandag is, het ons hem opgebouw. Hy was niks gezien. Onze beerman, meneer Rousseau, hy het 96 tot 1 kans gezien voor die plaats. Maar 97. Toen hij naar die plaats kijkt, toen zei hij, hy wil nou omkoop, toen is het te laat. Toen zei ons in de stad in de moeder. En ons het hem opgebouwd tot die zo.
Dit is een liefde raad met die plek. Ik moet zeggen.
Moved by the beneficiaries' fortitude and resilience, I wonder how we, as society, can contribute to the next chapter of this story. Thank you for joining me, Melusi Ngala, your host and executive producer for this Land and Corruption podcast. The music and sound engineering is by Calvin Buerta. A special thanks to Janine Rasmus, Tawanda Kaseke and Sboniso Nyite for all the work they did in putting this research project together. To the beneficiaries as well as all the other participants, this research would have not been possible were it not for your input and stories. This podcast series is made possible through funding received from Transparency International. For more on Corruption Watch's work, including research reports and toolkits on land corruption, please visit our website at www.corruptionwatch.org.za. Our email address is info@corruptionwatch.org.za, or you can give us a call at 011-242-3900.
#My hands are clean.